As I say, the average was about a 2.7, the usual kind of distribution. The first question, one of the difficulties was, I tried to take this into account, I posed it such that the client comes in looking for a recovery against the coal storage facility, but that in turn would really require, or at least it would be advisable to look at the claims against the barge owners as well. Some people said, hey, the instructions say only focus on the coal storage facility, so that's all I'm doing. And again, that was sort of ambiguous. I tried to take it into account. At the same time, there were some things you kind of had to look at to make sense of the problem. On the second question, the primary issue was essentially you had a terrible liability case and great damages. So you sort of had to you had to figure out why it was such a terrible liability case. Namely, we really don't know what happened. And I would say the primary mistake on the second question was overstating the evidence for negligence, and particularly overstating the evidence for proximate cause. That was a pretty dicey proposition. I don't know if you saw if you went and looked up or somebody gave you the cases that on which these were based. In the first case, both of them are modified from real cases. The first problem involved an appeal over nuisance. The claim was initially dismissed, and on appeal, the court said, no, there is both a private nuisance and a public nuisance claim. They also use a learned hand formula, at least the concurring opinion does. And then I made up the stuff about the, 80% and the lost records and that sort of stuff. But the central part of it, which would be not only using a negligence theory, but looking at a nuisance theory, that's all from the real case. The second case, was drawn from another real case where the plaintiff was suing the, driver. I think it was a claim on behalf of the grandchild against the grandmother, but the same logic would apply to the bridge owner, which would essentially be, trying to do a res ipsa theory, and the court said you don't have enough for a res ipsa theory because there's way too much in the way of alternative explanations, and res ipsa only applies where essentially you know enough about who caused what to be able to narrow it down to the defendant, and there's so many defendants here. Anyway, there are a variety of different sort of workarounds you can think about, but that's sort of my read of it. Any questions about that exam? When I first wrote the exam and before I'd really worked out the sample answer, I was thinking, this is a real short fact pattern and it's really not that hard, but the more I got into it, the less confident I was or would have been writing an answer. Nonetheless, I thought it fell within the sort of general admonition that I continue to give you, which is to try to identify what you know about the problem and what you don't know about the problem, and sort of working those two together to try to make sense of it. And some people did quite well, functioning within that environment, and some people had a greater degree of difficulty. So as I say, you may come up with questions later that you want to ask me. Okay, let's go back to the scene of the crime here, where we had gone through all of these statutes, and tried to get a sense of how these statutes function, how they generally work, so that we can begin to apply them in practice. As I say, these cases are just sort of a sample of the way in which courts take existing statutes or try to adopt rules consistent with them that raise a lot of these issues. Okay, so let's start with Laubach. The air conditioning go off, or have I just been running around here? Is it a little warm in here? But it's warm. Okay. I'm not just... Well, anyway. Okay. Laubach. Somebody want to tell me about Laubach here? I'll burst into a chorus of Oklahoma here if you don't watch out. Jones.
All right.
Actually, before you start, let me roll these noisy boards. Okay, now we're
ready. All right. There was a three-car collision, and the plaintiff sued Martin and Morgan for damages. Jury found that he was the damages were an amount of $4,000. They distributed negligence. So the plaintiff was found 30% negligent. Martin was found 50% negligent, and Morgan was found 20%.
Okay, so again, it's a typical kind of scenario where the jury allocates fault among different parties, including the plaintiff. And so what's the issue in the case?
Well, Morgan, the one that appealed, he said that, first of all, because there was less negligence than plaintiff.
Okay, and on what authority do they say the statute doesn't allow the plaintiff to recover from Morgan?
It says that you compare the negligence, as long as the negligence is more than that of the defendant.
Okay, well, that's the critical language. They say that a plaintiff's, in effect, the plaintiff can, well, actually what you said, the plaintiff can recover so long as the plaintiff's negligence is not greater than that of the defendant. This defendant says, well, hold the phone. The plaintiff hasn't met that condition because, according to the jury, the plaintiff's negligence is greater than my negligence. What's the plaintiff's answer to that?
I'm not more negligent than both of you combined.
Okay, this proper point of comparison is not this individual one-on-one deal. It's the plaintiff compared to the group of defendants as a whole. How do we know which of these two arguments is the proper resolution?
That's the judge. They look at.
By what criterion? What's the judge trying to do here?
Trying to decide what the purpose of the statute.
Yeah, what the legislature intended. Again, you know, we're just... reporting for duty here, says the judge. I'm trying to be the good servant of the legislature. I'm trying to figure out what they wanted. If they want one thing, I'll give it to them. If they want something else, I'll give them that. But the legislature didn't make explicit how this comparison is supposed to be done. And in the end, the court decides what?
That is compared to the defendant.
Okay, so the defendant's wrong in saying that because their negligence individually is less than the negligence of the plaintiff, they owe nothing. So long as the defendants as a group are more negligent than the plaintiff, they have to pay. But now the question is, how much do they have to pay? What does the court say?
The court says that they shouldn't be held jointly separately liable. You should just pay the amount of damages that equal to
Okay, the bad news is you got to pay. The good news is you only have to pay your individual share. So again, the court's trying to interpret this statute to figure out when the legislature creates these directions, how are these directions supposed to work out? And again, if I may refer to my cooking analogy, you know, you're reading the recipe and it says do this, do that. You're trying to figure out, well, in what order? Do I do this first and then that? Or is it, you know, sometimes the recipe card can be indistinct or ambiguous, and sometimes you sort of have to experiment with it or use your head to figure out, well, would it be logical for me to do this and then that or the other way around? So, again, in theory, we simply do what we're told, but oftentimes the statute's meaning is less than crystal clear. Now, we have the follow-up to Laubach versus Morgan, which is Boyles. What happens in Boyles? Dismissed out of this, right? Okay. So the ones who are left are these three defendants, and each is accused of having behaved negligently such that this building blows up. And again, it's a sort of typical comedy of errors where everybody thinks somebody else is taking care of something and the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. Pretty soon the place fills up with natural gas and explodes, injuring the plaintiff. Okay, so the plaintiff's Chapter 1 burden is to show that these people were negligent, and Chapter 2 that they proximately caused the injury, and Chapter 3 that they established damages. But now the question is, well, what do we do if the jury finds that all three of these people caused the injury? What does the trial judge do? And now the critical question is, what kind of liability is imposed on these three defendants?
They said that Laubach lied, and there were several liabilities.
Actually, I think the trial judge applies joint liability to all of them. Each is found, without differentiating, the jury doesn't say, well, you're this percentage, you're that percentage. The jury simply finds they're all liable and imposes liability. So who's grumpy about that? Yeah, the defendants say, whoa, we may be liable, but we should only be held liable for our percentage share. That's what the court said in Laubach, and aren't we following Laubach here? What's the plaintiff's response to that? Yeah, and this is a classic example of distinguishing a previous case. Again, just sort of the big picture of what you're doing in reading cases, going back to the T.J. Hooper case, you know, where Learned Hand says this broad statement, and the later court, or, you know, some later party picks up the statement and says, oh, look what the court said over here, and the other party wants to narrow that down and say, no, that applied to a specific kind of case. When Learned Hand talks about this stuff, he really means he's talking about cases where there's a a mixture or a variety of different practices. He didn't really mean that where there's universal disregard, or at least that wasn't the holding of it. So here, the court has said that after the adoption of this comparative fault rule, it's now essentially everybody pays their fair share and no more. The plaintiff is arguing in this case that rule doesn't apply, or it only applied in that case because the plaintiff was found to be at fault. You wouldn't want to apply that rule in this case where the plaintiff is not at fault. How might a defendant, we know how this case turns out, but how might a defendant respond to say, no, in fact, the court did mean that liability will be several only, even where the plaintiff is found to be at fault. Excuse me, even where the plaintiff is found not to be at fault. What kind of argument could you make by a defendant that that's the proper rule, that that's what the legislature should have intended or did intend by writing the statute? Why would that be fair? Lynch? That essentially the advent of comparative fault was good in many respects for the plaintiff, but this is one area where you sort of take the bitter with the sweet. As a plaintiff, you're happy with the advent of comparative fault that now the plaintiff's negligence doesn't bar the claim, but remember the good old days where only fault-free plaintiffs recovered and fault-free plaintiffs got a full recovery. Well, now the deal is plaintiffs who are found at fault may recover, but the bad news is you've lost joint and several liability. Not only in those cases where you're found to be at fault, but even in those cases where you are found to be at fault. After all, we're trying to make liability follow fault. They don't use that language, but it's the same sort of concept that we had in Lee versus Yellow Cab. The goal of comparative fault is we assign people a percentage of fault and you stick with that. Now, does the court buy that argument that the legislature intended for plaintiffs essentially to take the bitter with the sweet? No, they think that the advent of comparative fault was not meant to put any plaintiff in a position that was worse off. That is, you could say plaintiffs as a whole, you innocent plaintiffs are going to suffer because you negligent plaintiffs now get to recover. Well, you know, taken as a whole, you're better off, but some of you have profited and some of you have sort of had a little trade-off here. No, the idea is that the plaintiffs who are not at fault shouldn't be, in effect, punished in any way. Their status shouldn't be lowered in any respect through the advent of comparative fault. Again, what's the court trying to do here? But what is their ultimate criterion here? What are they, going back to how Mr. Jones described the court's ultimate intention here? Or goal is to fulfill the legislative intent. We're trying to figure out what did the legislature want. And again, what the court is thinking is, we can't really imagine that the court wanted to downgrade the status or make fault-free plaintiffs worse off than they were under the bad old days of the common law. After all, at common law, hardly a plaintiff-friendly environment, in a case like that, they'd get a full recovery. So, hey, we want to preserve that. Now, again, one of my purposes in presenting you with these cases is to show, gee, the courts are confronted with these issues where it's not entirely clear what the legislature wanted. They're trying to apply general principles to sort of figure out what makes sense from a policy standpoint. And in the end, many courts wind up thinking that the plaintiff's fault makes a difference. Even the Uniform Comparative Fault Act, which is not a function of politics or anything else, or at least, you know, not direct or electoral politics, Uniform Comparative Fault Act wants to make the plaintiff's fault relevant through this reallocation process. So many jurisdictions say it matters. Those plaintiffs who are fault-free get a better deal, not just in terms of whether their damages are reduced, but against whom they get a recovery. Here again, the court says we want the plaintiff to get a full recovery because a fault-free plaintiff deserves it, in effect. Will that mean that these defendants potentially pay more than their fair share? Potentially. But that's their tough luck. So, again, a fairly logical disposition here. Any questions about these two cases or the way in which the court followed its statute? Okay, now we get a pair of cases, Coney and American Motorcycle, which take a different view. And Coney is more sort of a survey of the variety of different statutes that retain joint and several liability and under what circumstances. And these are sort of out of order in a way because Coney post-dates American Motorcycle and relies on it to some extent. Can somebody tell me about Coney? Well, as I said before, Coney relies to a great extent upon American Motorcycle, raises the same issues of whether or not the adoption of comparative fault somehow abolishes or restricts the application of joint and several liability. And the court says, no, we don't think it does. And the last issue that's raised in Coney has to do with this, again, this constitutional challenge. Can the legislature, can the courts make a defendant pay in excess of their fair share? After you've determined what the defendant's fair share is, can you make the defendant pay more than that without violating the Equal Protection Clause? And as we've seen before, the court takes a relatively narrow view of what the Equal Protection Clause requires and says so long as there's a rational policy basis for it, and the rational policy basis is, there are actually a variety of different policy bases for retaining joint and several liability, the desire to make sure plaintiffs get compensated, the relative equities that somebody's going to get less than they deserve or pay more than they should, and it's just as rational, in fact more rational in the court's view to place this on the defendant than it is to place it on the plaintiff. Mr. Mitchell.
Did it, and you're going to make the same, and you're going to make the same case, and you're going to be liable.
Well, and I think defendants feel particularly troubled, annoyed, bitter, whatever the right adjective is, about the fact that the jury system itself has a kind of built-in sympathy for the plaintiff. In the defendant's perspective, it's not a particularly rational universe that they're operating within. But once the jury makes these allocations, insult is added to injury by the fact that the defendant is made to pay more than their fair share. Now, I think that's particularly compelling in those cases where the plaintiff's fault is actually greater than that of the defendant's. But again, in many jurisdictions, the statute or the court decisions, as in Oklahoma, reflect that perception and say, in effect, no, in these cases, defendants shouldn't pay more than their fair share. The difficulty, I think, arises when the plaintiff is not at fault and the defendant's only partially at fault. You're the city of Spokane. You run a city recreation league, and some kid behaves badly and hits somebody else with a baseball bat, and now you're being blamed for some head injury where the primarily responsible defendant is some 10-year-old kid who has no means to pay, but the city's got unlimited resources, or so the system seems to think, and now the city's paying for the plaintiff's damages, although the defendant's share of that is found to be 5 or 10%. So again, defendants get real grumpy real fast about this, and they go to their legislature and say to the legislature, fix this. Change the rules that make us pay more than our fair share. So one of the primary engines of tort reform has been reform of the joint and several liability rules. That's why you see in the Idaho statute this much more defendant friendly to the point of saying, you know, why is it that the defendant who's found partially responsible for this is limited, whereas the plaintiff who's found not responsible at all winds up having to take the share of the person who can't pay. So again, I'm not attempting to talk you out of your perception that this is a raw deal, but on either end of this spectrum, the more plaintiff-friendly or the more defendant-friendly, I hope you can see the people over there on the other end of the spectrum and understand sometimes those people are going to have the winning hand in the legislature, and you're going to have to live with the consequences, or at least your client will have to live with the consequences of the regime that's in place. But it also indicates that because there are these sort of equal and opposite reactions, the policies that are adopted often wind up sort of in this middle position where people are trying to compromise and split the difference and work it out. Okay, let's move to American Motorcycle, which is a complex case like Lee versus Yellow Cab. It is also from this sort of you might say the high water mark of judicial activism within the California court system, the era of, say, the decade of the 60s and the 70s, when lots of things were changing. You've got, the Vietnam War, you've got the sexual revolution, you've got the civil rights movement, you've got all these things going on in society, and the courts were often at the forefront of adopting new principles, and everybody sort of was thinking that we're kind of forging ahead and breaking new ground. I think that sort of enthusiasm has sharply receded, And there's much more of a kind of reticence on the part of courts to be as frisky as they once were. But American Motorcycle sort of reflects, I think, as does Lee versus Yellow Cab 3 years earlier, and other cases that we will read, a more sort of swashbuckling approach by the judiciary. Okay, and as I said before, this is the sequel we've been waiting for, Lee versus Yellow Cab, you know, the return of Lee versus Yellow Cab, or whatever. So can somebody describe the facts of it for us so we can lay it out? So just so we have the lineup, Glenn's the one who's injured. He sues these motorcycle clubs claiming they negligently designed the race and didn't properly, you know, inform him of the risks or what have you. In any event, again, we'd have all sorts of interesting Chapter 1 issues about whether or not they're really responsible for his injury, but the issue before the House now is, can they add another defendant whom they believe should share, who they believe should share in the responsibility? Now, I wouldn't call it a side issue, but sort of a puzzling omission here, which is some discussion of parental immunity. I would hope, as you read the facts of this case, you would say, now, how is it that the parents are defendants in this case? After all, doesn't this case arise from a parenting judgment? It wasn't that Glenn's father ran him over on a motorcycle. It's not bad motorcycling. It's bad parenting that's at stake. Isn't that covered by our classic immunity? And apparently the answer is, well, I don't know what the court's answer. They don't really address it. And whether there's a different rule in California or whether they figured we don't need to worry about that for purposes, what we want to do is announce our new rule with respect to joint several liability, multiple tortfeasor issues. But for whatever reason, that sort of drops off the table. And I hope you don't take this as a typical kind of a case with regard to parental immunity. I would have thought that would be a pretty good defense. Okay, but let's assume that we can proceed with that. First of all, what would American Motorcycle's dream opinion look like? If they could write the opinion for the California Supreme Court on this issue, what would their first ideal solution to the problem look like? Yeah. Okay, how does that affect the... Yes, they want to restrict their liability to their percentage of fault. So they go to the jury and say, well, okay, jury, we think we did a pretty good job, but if you find we were negligent, that's the way that the ball bounces. However, you've got to look at our negligence in comparison to the negligence of the parents, and when you assign us a share of fault, that's all we have to pay. So hopefully we could assign a percentage of fault to Glenn. We can assign a percentage of fault to the parents. And between, you know, American Motorcycle and Viking, we'll split the difference here. We're down to a pretty manageable kind of threat.
Even if parents are found to be immune by law, could they still argue that to say, well, they're immune, but they still have a potential policy for using by that now?
Yes, that would be...
They're insolvent.
Right, right. Now, as it turns out, the way the court resolves the case, it doesn't lend itself to that kind of conclusion. But that would certainly be another way that the American Motorcycle might be thinking this case would turn out. Okay, so the dream scenario is abolish joint several liability altogether. It's every man for himself here, and we'll be limited to our percentage share. Now, let's make sure we understand the state of the law when this case was initially filed. According to the law that was on the books when this case first got filed, what rights did American Motorcycle have vis-a-vis the parents? And hence, what did the trial court do with it? When the case was first filed, the defendants could make a claim for indemnity against the parents, but what would they have to prove to get that? They'd have to prove one of these exotic theories that we'll talk about down the road, which is essentially, you know, this primary, secondary, slight, you know, gross disparity, etc. These ways in which you can shift the entire liability to somebody else. But as it stood, you had no right to seek contribution or other kinds of claims against co-defendants. The law up until that point was essentially the holdover from the common law days, the pre-Lee versus Yellow Cab, where all defendants were essentially on the hook, because prior to Lee versus Yellow Cab, the only plaintiffs who could recover were fault-free plaintiffs, and as between a fault-free plaintiff and a negligent defendant, the courts essentially didn't care. So the liability gets unequally divided up amongst you negligent defendants. What do we care? Was the attitude before Lee versus Yellow Cab, and hence prior to American Motorcycle. So part of what the defendant is trying to do is to say the adoption of comparative fault in Lee versus Yellow Cab changed all that. Now, it's either every man for himself, that would be our ideal, but as a fallback position, we at least want to be able to go after the parents for their share of the fault. We want to be able to, let's suppose the jury says that we're negligent and the damages are $500,000, but the jury in turn finds that the parents were 50% responsible. We want the right to have a claim against the parents for $250,000. If the jury finds them to be half responsible and we have to pay the whole thing, we want to be able to go after the parents for their fair share. Now, again, when the defendants ask for an abolition of joint and several liability, the court says no. Does it say no the way the Oklahoma court said no? That is, we won't abolish joint and several liability as applied to fault-free plaintiffs, but we will abolish joint and several liability with respect to plaintiffs who are found at fault. Is that their solution to the problem? You furrow your brow in response. You don't think so. What did they say instead? How could they not abolish joint several liability for a plaintiff who's found partially at fault? Okay, they've got a bunch of reasons. You know, the question is, how can they do that? And sort of going back to Mr. Mitchell's, point, gee, this is rotten. I don't see... Well, the court's got some reasons why they do it. And you may find these reasons persuasive, or you may not. But one of them is to say, look, there's a difference between a defendant creating a risk of harm towards somebody else as distinguished from a plaintiff who creates a risk of harm to himself. Society has more to fear, in effect. Society has a greater incentive to punish or disincentivize, or whatever language you want to use, deter defendants from failing to use reasonable care for the safety of others than it does to have a disincentive for plaintiffs to fail to use reasonable care for themselves. So, okay, maybe wearing seat belts, maybe failing to wear seat belts is a major cause of injury, but it only happens after you're in an accident. A defendant who makes an illegal left turn causes an accident. A plaintiff who fails to wear a seat belt is only, enhancing what might otherwise have been a preventable injury. They don't talk about that, but I'm just giving you an illustration of how somebody might think that the negligence of the plaintiff is less significant or counts less than the negligence of the defendant. They have another reason why they're not going to abolish the rule for plaintiffs who are not at fault. Excuse me, for plaintiffs who are at fault. Yeah. I already sort of... one of their arguments for not abolishing it is they say, well, sometimes plaintiffs are not at fault. And I think everybody would give them that. Okay, when plaintiffs are not at fault, fine. Retain joint and several liability. But they go on to say, well, we want to keep it even when they are at fault. And one reason is their culpability is not as serious. The other reason is... again, this is as old as Bierman versus the City of New York, of saying, to the extent that we like this feature of the tort system, that it spreads losses, that it sort of functions like an insurance company, that it provides a mechanism for compensation, we sort of like that feature. And if we're torn between making the plaintiff suffer the loss and go uncompensated, or make the defendant pay more than their fair share, if neither one of them is deserved, we might as well give the plaintiff an undeserved benefit than to give the plaintiff an undeserved shortfall. If the plaintiff, but for the fortuity that one of the defendants happens to be insolvent, would otherwise get a relatively complete recovery, that would be a just outcome. Well, we're going to create a little injustice by making the other defendant pay rather than tell the plaintiff, I'm sorry, you have to go without the compensation that the jury awarded. Now, again, you may find this persuasive, you may not. But the court is using this as a rationale for saying, even if you find Glenn to be 20% at fault, and you find American Motorcycle to be 10% at fault, and you find the parents to be 70% at fault, guess what? Glenn is entitled to recover 80% of his damages from American Motorcycle and Viking, because we want to see that the plaintiff gets compensated. It's not an irrational policy choice. It may be the wrong policy choice, but again, this is the court's resolution of that dilemma. And as I said yesterday, I think, it provoked Justice Clark saying, look at the road we've traveled down. We first abolished the old common law rule in Lee versus Yellow Cab under the banner, liability should follow fault. Now that we have an opportunity to actually live up to that, we throw it overboard so we can make sure the plaintiff gets compensated. This stinks. But again, he's writing in the minority here. And the majority finds that these arguments are persuasive. Okay, there's another issue in the case which has to do with settlement, and that's something that we'll take up in the next case, but I want to make sure we at least understand what the dilemma is. Suppose we find the plaintiff is 20% at fault. Actually, I think the example that's given is the plaintiff is 30% at fault, one of the defendants is 10% at fault, and another defendant is 60% at fault. If the plaintiff settled with his parents, suppose the parents had an insurance policy that covered this case. Suppose it was an ordinary automobile accident case where we didn't have a parental immunity issue. The plaintiff settles with the parents for $10,000. What is the liability of the remaining defendant? Suppose the jury says that the damages are $100,000, how much will AMA have to pay if the plaintiff settles with the parents for $10,000? How do you get there?
Kind of arbitrarily, but it's the 30% damages on top, and then...
Okay, let's just track this here. His damages are $100,000. You took off 30% because that's his share. That's the plaintiff's fault.
Right.
You got $70,000. Then what'd you do? So he's already received $10,000. The balance of $60,000. Yeah. And again, Justice Clark says, oh, and this is liability following fault. The defendant, who's only 10% at fault, has to pay $60,000. Where'd you get that? Now, in a way, it's a related. In a way, you should sort of see this coming to the extent that the court has already said, we're going to make defendants pay on the basis of joint and several liability because we see all kinds of good policy reasons for that. But you could raise a different kind of argument in the settlement arena by saying, well, it's one thing if the plaintiff has no choice in the matter. If there's a defendant who can't pay their share and the plaintiff can't do anything about it. But where the plaintiff chooses to engage in a settlement, a different logic should apply. Then the plaintiff should be made responsible for the consequences of the choice to settle, rather than essentially be able to be irresponsible in engaging in an inadequate settlement and then make the non-settling defendant make up the difference. Plaintiff, if you want the freedom to settle with whoever you want to settle, you're going to have to handle that responsibly. And again, the court, in announcing this new rule to the lawyers and everybody else practicing in this area, says, okay, the way we're going to handle settlement is we're going to treat the settlement as a dollar reduction, of course, with the potential that the remaining defendant is getting a raw deal, but we don't quite know what else to do. Okay, we'll pick up settlement in the next chapter, but I want to finish this case on the note of talking about indemnity. And again, the court's description of what it did here. This is the section beginning on page 21 here. It is 21. Yeah. Beginning on page 21, it says, This section 3 in the right-hand column, it kind of gives you the historical background. Let's talk about indemnity for a moment. The word indemnity is the idea of essentially taking the place of, or it's sort of the word for compensating for. And you know, you may have heard the expression, the ad damnum clause, in a pleading, for example, where that's the part in which you state your damages. Which damaged the plaintiff to the following in the following respect. Well, indemnity is a way of essentially taking that damage and substituting something for it. You often find that an insurance company will have the word indemnity written into it. So it'll be the, you know, such and so casualty and indemnity company or something like that. Again, the idea is that the insurance company makes up for or pays for a loss that you have suffered. Now, the court looks at this history of indemnity actually coming from two different sources. One is the idea of contractual indemnity, where I can agree to pay for something, or I can buy insurance that essentially obligates somebody else to indemnify me. I can sign a construction contract or some other kind of contract in which I agree to sort of make up for whatever loss is suffered. So, for example, if I want to borrow somebody's building or rent it for some event, I'm going to have a rock concert at the Martin Center, I may have an indemnity clause built into that. Say, you know, if I damage this thing, I'll make up for it. So contractual indemnity, you know, two different parties through insurance or for the right amount of money, they can agree, okay, in the event you get hurt, I'll make up for it. But there's another form of indemnity, equitable indemnity. And this is not based on any agreement, but is based on principles of equity. Again, where the court has the power to do the right thing, to make some sort of fair allocation. And the court says, historically, we've had this principle of equitable indemnity, but you know what? We haven't been very consistent about it. Where there are two defendants, and both defendants are held liable, we've occasionally allowed one defendant to shift the loss to the other defendant, where one was a passive tortfeasor and the other was an active tortfeasor, where one was primarily responsible and the other one was secondarily responsible, where one had slight negligence and the other was substantial. And I'm trying to remember where they have a list of this here. This is at the bottom of page 22 in the right-hand column. And the court looks back at these cases, and in this last paragraph on page 22, as one court of appeal has charitably stated, the cases are not always helpful in determining where this line is to be drawn. So what you have is a series of inconsistent cases in which sometimes they give it, sometimes they don't. It's hard to find the dividing line. And what they did come up with is the idea of partial equitable indemnity. It doesn't need to be a complete displacement from one defendant to another. It can be a partial indemnity, again, based on equitable principles. But when we get there, we've essentially arrived at the idea of contribution. And the court says, from here on in, we're going to have a principle of general right to contribution. If you're forced to pay more than your fair share, you can go find the people that helped to cause this injury and make them pay their fair share. This may be cold comfort to the defendants in this case because they're the ones with money and the people they're supposed to be able to go after for indemnity or for contribution don't have anything. And that's why the defendants started by saying, we don't even want to have to pay more than our fair share. Again, by analogy, if I'm sitting at the table when all my friends have disappeared and the waiter's trying to collect the bill, I'd much rather have it be separate checks at that point than have the waiter say, oh, I will hereby give you the right to go collect from your friends. Well, big deal. That doesn't cheer me up very much. That's a forlorn hope in many cases. But at least it's something that the court is offering. So again, most of this is now done, and for your purposes, you will see it on the exam in the form of a statute, where a statute will first resolve the issue about joint and several liability. Are we going to impose joint and several liability? Under what circumstances? Only when the plaintiff is fault-free? Or even when the plaintiff is partially at fault? Does it matter how much of the liability? For example, Oregon would say a 10% defendant can't be forced to pay more than their fair share. But a defendant who's 30% or more can be forced to reallocate under the principles they describe. So, again, all of these things can vary depending upon the way the legislature finds, where it finds the best balance to lie. But if they do make the defendant pay more than their fair share, they almost always say, oh, and by the way, you can track down your fellow defendants, and if they're good for it, you can force them to pay their fair share and even things out. Okay, I'm going to leave it at that, and we'll come back after the break and look at Techville.
I understand why the court would have.